Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. It was the legendary Warren Buffett who once said that it is far better to pay to buy a wonderful company at a fair price than a fair company at a wonderful price. So much has been said around valuations just this year, and I suspect so much more is to be said if we are to look at where the market finds itself at the moment. I'm Jimmy Mwaha. This is the SAFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at the latest results out of Gold Fields. They reported their interim results for the first 6 months of their new financial year. We speak to the company's chief executive officer, Mike Frazier, around that performance, get a sense of where it is that business is headed. Then we take a look at a state-owned entity in a broadband InfraCo that has failed to turn a profit in 6 years. We try and make sense of what's been driving that business and what some of the factors around that SOE have been. We also have a conversation with immigration expert, Adil Wadi, around the new proposed penalties by the Department of Employment and Labour around employers that are looking to hire undocumented foreign nationals. There could be some financial implications thereof that are escalating. We take a look at that and see what we make of that. And then we have a conversation with the team at Old Mutual on how it is that they are preparing businesses to access funding by bridging the investment readiness gap that small businesses often find themselves facing. We take a look at how it is that the latest initiative that they've put together could potentially assist small businesses in this respect. And we wrap up the show with an agri conversation. We take a look at our citrus finding new home in Indian markets and what it's taken to get to that point.
The day's markets. Clear insights on today's winners, losers, and what to do next.
As always, that's where we kick off the show with a sense of market movements. I'm joined on the line by Head of Investment Research at F&B Wealth and Investments, Chantal Marks, to take a look at the latest movements and see if we can make sense of them. Chantal, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for the time. 15 Rand 94. That's all. 15 Rand 94. We've broken 16 Rand. We can finally celebrate.
Yeah, I mean, if you're not an exporter, of course, you are weeping in your hands. But yeah, 15.94. I wouldn't have expected that if you asked me about that yesterday, even less so a week ago. But here we are, the Rand regaining some proper strength. A lot of it has to do with a weaker US dollar. But if you look at the Rand in terms of its performance today, it was the third strongest major currency relative to the US dollar. So it did stand on its own 2 feet as well.
Chantal, let's take a look at some of the factors around the Rand. I mean, obviously, some of them have been at play for quite some time. You and I spoke about the tailwinds that we got last year with changes that benefited South Africa coming off the grey list. And coming into this year, we were on relatively strong footing. And then the central bank surprised us with an interest rate decision that might have been unpopular in the latest decision, but that seemingly worked out in the end when the reasons that were given were reasons that actually then played out in the market. The Rand has been on course to kind of really realize some of the value that it has been under pressure of, if we look at now versus perhaps this time last year.
Yeah, absolutely. So there is the domestic story that is looking a little bit better, obviously slightly derailed by what's happening in the Middle East. But if you look at structural reform, if you look at South Africa's fiscal position, at our terms of trade, commodity prices even are still quite supportive of South Africa's terms of trade. And then you have external factors as well. So something like a move away from the US dollar is quite supportive of the Rand. And you have emerging markets also comparatively offering better value relative to domestic markets. Well, South Africa hasn't gotten a lot in terms of portfolio flows yet, particularly on the equity front. I do think that there has been more interest in our South African public assets. So there would have been a positive impact there as well.
Chantal, can we take a look at the rest of the markets? Equity markets having a better time of today. I mean, yesterday seemed like more red than green if we had a look at some of these equities. We're seeing a lot more green today. Perhaps the market is finally adjusting to some of the factors. I know that from a local perspective, at least, we've got a couple of results coming out. They've been coming out in bits and pieces. So we're not necessarily in the thick of our results season. But I want to get a sense of where you're seeing equity markets performances at this stage of the year.
Yeah, I mean, so if we look at this year so far, it really has been topsy-turvy. So if we look at the year-to-date headline level for the JSE, we are sitting at 0.75% higher. So that in itself doesn't look that great. We've had resources being widely supportive, even though the last 6 months hasn't looked that great. We've had a bit of a dulling on the precious metal front, but generally we have had some reasonable support there. If we look at financials, though, there we have seen some pressure, but I think a lot of that had to do with the pressure that we're seeing on the consumer. So inevitably, that does filter through there. But our worst performer so far this year has actually been the industrial space. And that really has been a function of some of the larger companies that are in that industrial sector that in actual fact has very little to do with South Africa. So I'm thinking about Prosus and Naspers, most of their exposure being to China and Europe, as well as some kind of more recent pressure on some of the rand hedges, given our very strong rand. In terms of the domestics, it's also not been that great. And a lot of that has had to do with the retailers and with consumer-facing stocks. And this much higher oil price filtering through to the petrol pumps, resulting in high interest rates, really hasn't been great for our stock market.
Chantal, can we take a look at the latest unsolicited offer received by Northam Platinum? I saw that sense come out, and I remember back in 2023, we were having conversations around the Implats business and the Royal Bafokeng bids, and there was a bidding war in the platinum space, and then the platinum price went through a bit of a dip, and everybody kind of left and ran away. Just today, Northam confirmed via sense that they've received their shareholders, the management team rather, had received an unsolicited offer for that business. I want to get your thoughts around that, not just in isolation from a Northam perspective, but it says a lot about the fact that PGMs might now come into favor overnight as well, as we've seen the platinum price rally as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I hope it's not a signs of a bit of a top, yeah. But I do think that a lot of this has to do with kind of longer term sustainability considerations. So if you look at the PGM space, we do have a few major players, and then there are kind of smaller companies, some of them listed, some of them unlisted. But with very cyclical companies, it is quite difficult to keep your eye on the ball, I would guess, especially when you have quite a bit of volatility in your kind of main pricing mechanism, being PGMs in this case, also impacted by the rand, now also impacted by costs. So in that context, consolidation starts making a lot of sense. Northam specifically has two mines that are right next to Valterra's mines. Now, Valterra, we don't know who the bidder is. We honestly don't, but my sense is that would probably be the most likely suitor. I am now just a little bit, I don't know, we have a competition commission, Jimmy. And I, even though most of these company success is kind of dictated to by external factors, consolidation makes sense. I'd be interested to see their take on something potentially this large. Northam is one of the top four producers in South Africa. Valterra is the biggest.
Again, just to reiterate what Chantal Marx is saying, we do not have inside information. This conversation is not financial advice, if you think it might be. We're speculating, as all of the other market participants might be speculating, but certainly we find ourselves in a very, very unique position. I know Chantal and I will both be keeping an eye on how this transaction unfolds. If indeed there is a transaction, we will of course reach out to the Northam team and they will give us an update if they have one to provide. For now though, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Head of investment research at FNB Wealth and Investments, Chantal Marks, joining us to reflect on market movements, market announcements, and where we find ourselves on this Tuesday.
We're not just interested in banking businesses. We're interested in building better ones. Because the true value of a bank isn't what it provides. It's what it makes possible. Simpler operations, greater adaptability, long-term resilience. Think bigger. Think Nedbank Commercial Banking. See money differently. Nedbank. We're licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
Sure, it's great knowing my net worth's denominated in dollars, euros, pounds, and rands. But that's not why I'm a client of Standard Bank Private. This is surprising my bro in the States on his birthday.
Surprise! It's not what you do that matters, but who you do it for. Get an offshore account with 4 currency options and pay no monthly maintenance fees. Search Standard Bank Private for more. Standard Bank, it can be. Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
Goldfields Limited, one of South Africa's oldest gold producing companies listed on the JSE, today released their results, interim results, that is, for the 6 months ended 30 June 2026. There's an interim dividend to be declared. There is stronger cash flows as a result of a very lovely gold price, and we're going to be taking a look at these and other movements within that business with the company's Group Chief Executive Officer, Mike Fraser. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of their performance. Mike, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. The start of the new financial year, arguably absolutely where any gold mining company wants to be with the gold price, but it hasn't been without some prior financial periods not being so great. How do you reflect on this first half of the new year?
Look, I think a couple of things I'd say is that, you know, firstly, to take advantage of a higher gold price, you have to have a business that's operating and performing. And pleasingly, what we've seen in the first half of this year is actually all around a pretty solid performance from the company. It was safe. We were able to deliver very strong performance out of Salares Norte, and that delivered a very strong operating base performance. And when you combine that, sales volumes up 18%, production up 12%, gold prices up 50% on the same period, it meant that our the leverage effect meant that our our cash flow was up 134% year on year. So it really was an all-round, very, very strong performance from the group, and very pleasingly, because as you rightly call out, you know, 2 years ago we were challenged at Salares in ramping it up, but really it demonstrated that the design was right, the team is right, and we're delivering good outcomes from that asset.
Mike, let's take a look at that important factor around how it is that the business operates in times like this. It's very easy to run away with a stronger gold price, with cash flows that are, when compared to the previous financial first half of the year, almost triple what they are or what they were back then. It's very easy to say, well, the business is in a comfortable position. We can kind of relax a bit and take a bit of a breather. How important is it to then continue to maintain a focus in line with the strategy? I mean, from a business perspective, there is still an underlying strategy to be executed on.
Absolutely right. And I mean, for Goldfields and for us, we know that sustainability is going to come around from continuing to drive the quality of the performance out of the business. What that means is growing cash flow per share. The way that we do that is by continuously improving the quality of our portfolio and the ounces that we add to our business. But in addition, making sure that we continue to improve the base business. You can't stand still. I think what you are finding in this cycle, certainly in this gold cycle, the gold producers are being a lot more disciplined and certainly are being held to account for the way that they allocate capital and the free cash. And, you know, ultimately, that's what's going to make a difference in relative performance, both in terms of total shareholder returns through direct dividends and buybacks, as well as delivering capital growth through share price appreciation. So I think you're finding a very, very different type of gold equity market than maybe you would have experienced 10 years ago. There's a huge amount more discipline in the sector today and a lot more expectation about disciplined operating performance.
Mike, what is the strategy from a business perspective? You're 6 months in, cash flows, as we said, almost triple what they were the 6 months of the previous financial year. Net debts are down. You've managed to do the smart thing, pay down the debt, free up the balance sheet. How then does the business look at the strategy? Because on the one side, the gold price might not run this hard forever, and that is something that's always going to be sitting at the back of your minds as gold producers. But at the same time, this windfall from a financial point of view could be some really good opportunity to achieve some other strategic objectives. How does the management team strike that balance and approach not only the rest of this year, but subsequent years that might follow?
Yeah, look, I think the one thing I would say is that our strategy is unchanged. So, you know, we know that this is a cyclical industry. We are in a very privileged position where we are generating very good cash flows at the moment. And you know, frankly, the outlook for gold continues to remain positive for the next few years. So we think we should be in a reasonably good position for the next few years. And so what we are doing is we compete in a couple of ways. Is one is being very disciplined about investing for the future for our business. So we are making some discretionary investments. You know, one is our Windfall project in Canada, which is a growth project for us. Secondly, we are investing in some of our assets in Australia as well as South Deep to really try and unlock the future potential of those assets, because sometimes those internal brownfields are the best opportunities. And then what we also want to do is ensure that our shareholders get rewarded, as well as strengthening our balance sheet. And so, you know, today, once you take the before paying out our dividend, we actually cash positive already. And so that's a very, very different environment that we're in. So we've got a strong balance sheet that allows us to be agile and take advantages of opportunities as they arise. We are differentially investing in our business so we set it up for future success and rewarding our shareholders for today. And I think the kind of cash flows that we're generating allows us to do all of those things, which is a pretty remarkable place to be.
Mike, let's wrap up the conversation with that reward to shareholders at the moment. Interim cash dividend being declared by the business as a result of the stronger performance. But by and large, Goldfield has over the years aimed to maintain a level of reward to shareholders. Now it's nice to be able to look at previous year's interim dividends and say, hey, we might even be able to do a little bit more whilst the market is in our favor.
Yeah, and look, I think what we absolutely target on a dividend basis is to deliver a top quartile returns to shareholders once you've included dividends and buybacks. And I think we've absolutely been able to demonstrate that over the last few years. I think what's important to note, though, is that we still think that our stock is underappreciated and undervalued by the market, where our EV and EBITDA multiples are amongst the lowest of our peer group, despite having one of the highest cash flow yields. So we certainly believe that if we can continue to deliver operating performance, continue to deliver strong cash flows, and continue to reward shareholders, that there will be more interest in our stock going forward. So, you know, I think certainly that's a key part of our value proposition that we aim to achieve.
The gold price may be higher than it has been in quite some time, but that does not mean that our gold miners are relaxing and not paying attention to the market. They're doing everything they can to make sure that these windfalls that they're currently experiencing go on for as long as possible to benefit shareholders and investors. All the best to you, Mike, and the team for the next 6 months. We certainly look forward to catching up at the end of the year. Mike Fraser, Chief Executive Officer at Goldfields, joining us to take a look at their first 6 months of the new financial year, how the business is faring, and where their focus is ahead of the rest of the year.
In case you're on the highway, driving to your first big maize delivery, and something mysterious happens. You stop at the garage to scope the damage. You realize the fuel system's kinda dear macar. You panic. But then you take a deep breath. Because you know Hino Care Gap Cover is there to cover anything outside the standard 6-year warranty. From steering columns to ABS control modules, it's the unseen essential in your business. Speak to your Hino dealer. T's and C's apply. Hino. All the way.
With a complete view of your finances, Nedbank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, Nedbank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. Nedbank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
The South African Department of Employment and Labour has put forward the Employment Services Amendment Bill that aims to potentially look at how it is that employers are held accountable for the undocumented foreign nationals that they employ. Currently, there is a Section 38 of the Immigration Act that speaks to some penalties that can be imposed on employers that employ undocumented foreign nationals. And the latest proposal is that these penalties be increased in their severity. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with senior immigration consultant at Expat Web, Adil Wadi. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Adil, good evening. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with an overview of the current amendment bill that is sitting before Parliament for review. Give us an understanding of where we stand with that particular process, what the penalties are that are currently in place, and what is being proposed.
Yeah, of course. Jimmy, thank you so much for having me, and good evening to your listeners as well. So I think the starting point at the moment for a lot of people out there, because there is a lot of talk surrounding this bill at the moment, but we have to remember that as it currently stands, it is a bill. So it's currently with the portfolio committee before it gets passed into law. So it's not finalized as yet. But there is a lot of changes which seek to make immigration or the employing actually of foreign nationals in South Africa more stringent. The part I want to touch on that is specifically with regards to obviously practicing in immigration is the Department of Home Affairs themselves, as we've currently seen the landscape, they're seeking to actually make it a little bit easier to actually mobilize talent into South Africa. So almost a little bit contradictory on that front itself. But with the review of this bill and what it seeks to impose, I think the key point for a lot of individuals out there is the new fines which need to be introduced, whereby they've set fixed amounts. Currently, it is actually governed under Section 38 of the Immigration Act, whereby imposition of either fines or jail time is part of the act itself, but the fines themselves have not been defined in terms of the amounts. So the scary part for a lot of employers out there at the moment is with regards to the fines going anywhere from 100,000 rand up to 1 million, or even in some certain circumstances, even more than that. And I think that's the scary part at the moment.
Adil, you touched on the fact that the Department of Home Affairs has taken a slightly different approach here, and I suppose the main differentiator here is we're looking at undocumented foreign nationals versus those who are legitimately in South Africa. I want to take a look at the penalties in a bit more detail and get a sense of perhaps some of the unintended consequences that could come up for businesses that are legitimately seeking the expertise of legitimate foreign service providers and foreign nationals. How could we possibly find ourselves in a tough spot given that some of our sectors and some of our industries do currently face a skills shortage, and I suppose that's what we're trying to drive with the Department of Home Affairs side of things?
Yeah, no, of course. So when it comes to undocumented foreign nationals, right, so illegal foreign nationals in South Africa, the Immigration Act already basically imposes on employers, it's deemed to be that they know they actually are employing undocumented foreign nationals, and that's when the fines or imprisonment can be imposed on them, because it's deemed that they already know. So there's a lot of emphasis placed on employers themselves to make sure that any individual who is employed by the company has been vetted properly, has the correct documentation, because if they are deemed to be an illegal foreigner, then obviously those fines and imprisonment can be imposed. With regards to the skills shortage specifically, I mean, the department is obviously very aware with that. With regards to a lot of the long-term visa options already available for South Africa itself, those cater to various different needs depending on the individual themselves. There's also options out there in terms of visa options whereby if it's for low-lying employees or low-level employers, there is something known as a corporate visa, etc. That's often the case with regards to farm workers, for example. So they've tried to cater for everyone, whether it be skills in a multinational company or it might be a farmer who requires certain expertise for the type of fruit he's growing. So at the end of the day, they have tried to cater for every one of those individuals. It's now on the employer to make sure that, yes, sometimes I do understand that it takes a little bit of time to try and get those visas out. And that's where a lot of the problem comes in, is due to the time aspect. But the problem is those mechanisms do actually exist at the end of the day. So therefore, relying on the fact that, oh, we just can't get them in because there's a skills shortage and we had to bring them in as soon as possible, that unfortunately will not suffice as an applicable excuse when the Department of Labor or the Department of Home Affairs or SAPS rocks up at your business and basically they ask, why do you have an illegal foreigner? It's the fact of the matter is you were supposed to actually follow the certain route which is laid out as per the Immigration Act itself.
Adil, before I let you go, I want to take a closer look at that route and the practical steps that companies, prospective employers, can explore when looking to have legally compliant
Sure.
foreign professionals come and work in South Africa, because that's also quite important if we are to find that some businesses require these services. There, as you said, there is a route to go by. There are practical steps to follow here. Where should we start, especially given that we don't know if this bill is going to move ahead or not as yet, but businesses need
to prepare. Of course. So I fully agree. Businesses do need to prepare because, again, I just want to touch on the fact that as much as this bill isn't passed, the fact that the Immigration Act already has certain fines and imprisonment already in bill system, it means that we don't have to wait for the bill to be passed before employers start stressing. I feel like they should have started stressing almost yesterday already, because with the way the country is currently going and the amount of inspections, etc., which is going on, it is crucial for employers to make sure that they are doing things the correct way. So the starting point for most employers out there, employ foreign nationals or have foreign nationals currently employed within their business, is to first vet the documents that those nationals currently have. And super important to do so, and something I want to touch on, is it's not just the fact that an employee comes to you and produces a visa or permanent residence, etc. There is a deeper look into that which has to be done. There's obviously a lot of fraudulent documents out there which have to be looked at. And secondly, the visa itself is always specific to the scenario of that individual. So the conditions on a visa, for example, differ from case to case. So it's always important to first do that. And it's something we call, there's one of two ways as a starting base, is either formal verification itself, which is done through the Department of Home Affairs, whereby they will verify the authenticity of that visa itself. Or sometimes you can do something as a informal verification through third parties, whereby there's professionals who look at the documents of your employees to make sure that they are legit. So, or they provide you at least a basis to say that on face value, this is what it appears to be. So that is a very good starting point for employers out there, because they have to vet the people they currently employ. For future planning, it's always important to identify the type of situation which you're currently in, why the employee needs to come to South Africa. And then on that basis, we need to qualify it against the Immigration Act to see which category itself actually allows that employee to come in on that specific basis. So future planning a little bit easier, because now we know we have to make sure that we obviously deal with each scenario on a specific basis. But for current employees in your employ, it is extremely important right now to just make sure, just because they have a visa doesn't mean they're here legally. It means you have to make sure that that visa itself is correct for the position which they're in within your company.
Some potentially significant changes on the cards for employers looking to hire foreign nationals in South Africa. Of course, this conversation is an ongoing one. It has been ongoing for the longest time, and we'll keep an eye on how it is that these developments may financially impact employers going forward. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Senior immigration consultant at Expat Web, Adil Wadi, joining us to take a look at the latest amendment bill being put forward for consideration around penalties for those who employ undocumented foreign nationals.
We're not just interested in banking businesses. We're interested in building better ones. Because the true value of a bank isn't what it provides. It's what it makes possible. Simpler operations, greater adaptability, long-term resilience. Think bigger. Think Nedbank Commercial Banking. See money differently. Nedbank. We're licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
Did you know? Recent rain does not always mean your soil is at field water capacity. Omnia can help determine plant available water, giving producers a view of their planting risk profile. It's one more way Soil Insight helps reduce production risk. Omnia Nutriology. Better farming starts with understanding your soil.
Welcome to Mzansi, where the vibe is always on, but the lights are off. where we smile through dark times with the hope of a bright future. Where the grass seems greener on the other side, but we choose to go green here. Where Look-See helps improve your home's energy efficiency through quality products, solutions, and services. Visit looksee.co.za to learn more about home energy efficiency. Powered by Standard Bank. Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
There is a state-owned entity known as Broadband Infraco, which is a company that was founded back in 2007. It is the state-owned broadband provider that we've that we have in the country. The business currently has assets of 1.5 billion rands and liabilities of 1.8 billion rands, which make it technically insolvent as it has a negative equity of around 300 million rand. This is according to the Department of Telecommunications and Digital Services, the department responsible for overseeing this particular entity. They reported to Parliament most recently around the performance of that entity. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with economist at Business Day, a good friend of ours, Mudiwa Kavaza, to see if we can make sense of this particular company and where it finds itself. Mudiwa, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. Give us a background around why Broadband Infraco was formed. I know you've kept an eye on this business for quite some time. Why did it exist in the first place?
So when a number of, you know, different entities, you know, firstly, good evening, Jimmy, always good to talk to you. But a couple of years ago, when all the different carve-outs are happening of, you know, different state-owned enterprises and the like, some of the assets that had been built up you know, around the likes of Transnet, around the likes of Eskom in terms of fiber, you know, it was decided that actually we should have a separate broadband infraco, basically an infrastructure company. Think of OpenServe, think of Frogfoot, think of Dark Fiber Africa, you know, those private players, think of Liquid, right? You know, they said, okay, fine, yeah, these assets, let's create an entity that will look after these assets that are existing and will go out on a commercial basis, you know, and provide that infrastructure to telecoms industry, but also at the same time help to drive the developmental piece of, you know, the government's connectivity agenda. So in essence, that's what we're looking at when we talk about Broadband Infraco.
Mudiwa, how did the business then find itself in its current position? There are assets under the, within the business, there are liabilities within the business, but the business has somehow, for the last 5 years, at least from 2020 up to now, reached combined losses of around 836-odd million rand, as reported by the department. That is a business that isn't looking to do much better. Still, in the words of the department, is a business that is in financial distress. How did we get to this point?
There's a number of different things that we would have to look at, because it's not one thing that has led the company to be where it is, but almost like a perfect cocktail, you know, of headwinds that have come together, right? So one of the biggest ones, you heard me earlier on mentioning some of the private players. Back in the day, it was Telkom. You know, now all of those assets in Telkom fall under OpenServe. But back in the day, you know, Telkom was the main, you know, game, name in the game. We also had the likes of Neotel, whose assets were bought up by Liquid. And then over time, we've now got DFA, Dark Fiber Africa. We now have Frogfoot. We now have Metro Fiber. We now have, you know, all of these different, you know, Octatel and the others. So the type of business where back in the day, Broadband Infraco was one of a few or one of the ones that was really looked at. The rise of private competition in the space has worked in such a way that whatever the customer churn, those people that were customers have gone on, you know, to sit with some of the other players. So increased competition has definitely hurt Broadband Infraco in a really big way. The other thing is what I mentioned earlier on about that developmental agenda. Because it is state-owned, they also have to lead some of the big connectivity and broadband projects that government wants to do, such as the South Africa Connect project, going out and, trying to connect the underserved areas. Now, you and I have had conversations about how in underserved areas, they're underserved because in many instances, they're either in rural or outlying areas, and the private players usually do the calculus and decide that it's not commercially viable to go and build in those areas or to do business in those areas. Well, because of the developmental piece, Broadband Infraco has to go into, some of those areas, and they do so at a high cost because they have to drive some of these government projects. So I would say there's a lots of different factors we can get into, but those are probably your two main ones. The increased competition that has come through in recent years. I mean, just this week alone, we had two big funding announcements, COMSOL, which is a wireless provider, last week, and then yesterday, Frogfoot announcing, big amounts of money coming in from SabVest, DNI, valuing that company at $8 billion. So you need a lot of capital to play, in this game. And we all know that, when it comes to government pockets, they tend to be stretched.
Modiwa, speaking of capital to play in the game, we know that the game is changing. We know the landscape is changing. We've seen this from our telcos. You and I have spoken about what the telcos bring to the market. We've also spoken about how it is that connectivity is changing for South Africa and the African continent. Is there still value in holding this? Because another conversation that's been emerging is, does the state need to have all of the state-owned entities that it currently does have, or is there strategic value in letting go of certain assets? If we are looking at where the business stands now versus where the market is now, how do we move forward?
What's interesting about this is that you've got government that has various projects. We mentioned SA Connect now. And in many instances, you can partner with the private sector, but the private sector would typically come in on commercial grounds for some of these projects. So yes, it does help to have your own arm to be able to do these things. However, what is the extent to which you're going to support this type of investment, right? I think the model that was used around Telkom would probably work the best for something like this, especially given the large capital requirements in something of this nature. I think to maybe give a sense, remember that just before Vodacom and Maziv came together, rather Vodacom and Remgro's fiber businesses came together, Standard Bank had actually come together and put together a nice package for them to say, we've created a 25 billion rand facility for you guys to go out into the market and build what you need to build. Does Broadband Infraco even have access to, that type of funding? Because it's a capital game that you need to have. And what's interesting to your question is that we're talking about fiber right now and, some of these assets, but we're also talking about this at a time when government is actually contemplating, having some type of, state-owned satellite provider of some sort. So the hopes and dreams of government around connectivity are big, but a lot of it is just going to come down to how well the state is able to fund these connectivity dreams.
Does Broadband Infraco then become the empowerment partner of someone like Starlink? Do we sell off the business? Do we sell off the assets and settle the liabilities and just move ahead? Lots to be done, but what we know is a state of severe financial distress cannot be maintained or allowed to continue if we can do anything about it. We'll see how this shapes up. For now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. Modiwa Kavaza, economist at Business Day and good friend of ours, thanks for joining us to take a look at the state of Broadband Infraco and where we could move to from here.
Hi, I need finance to transport crops.
You need to get it to the right ports. With a buyer lined up across the ocean. And assurance you'll get paid. Plus funding for next season.
Well, I was thinking basic asset finance, but financial solutions...
That make global trade happen.
Is what I should be thinking.
At Nedbank, we see more than farming. From agriculture production loans to global trade expertise, we help agribusinesses think bigger. Think Nedbank Commercial Banking. See money differently. Nedbank. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
This interview is brought to you by Old Mutual. For many small businesses, access to funding is critical to ensuring the success of their business. And for many of the businesses that look to access funding, they're always told that the business isn't ready for investment. There's a conversation around investment readiness that needs to be had. And we're going to be having just that conversation with the head of investments at the Masisi Zane Fund within the Old Mutual Group. Thabang Tleze joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Thabang, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. When we talk about investment readiness in the context of small businesses, and particularly businesses looking to raise capital or raise financing, what do we mean?
Good afternoon, Jim, and afternoon to the SFM listeners. Maybe just before I answer a question, let me just give an overview briefly on who Masisi Zane is. So we are an initiative of the Old Mutual Group, and for the last 19 years, our mission has really been to how do we create lasting impact in the communities you're operating in by making a meaningful dent against poverty, inequality, and unemployment through SME development. Practically, this says, how do you address the three main challenges that SMEs are facing, right? Access to market, access to finance, which we'll touch on shortly, and adequate capacity building. So our investment readiness program, which we'll double-click on later in these challenges and make businesses more fundable. So back to your question. So, and it's very true. So access to finance is one of the major stumbling blocks to SME growth. And you often hear of a funding gap of about 350 billion. This is not because there's a shortage of capital to meet SME funding requirement, or there's a shortage of businesses seeking capital. I think we have enough funding mandates and probably the most sophisticated financial system in the continent, but yet we have very low approval rates. So one of the recurring gaps we see in our business is not a shortage of good businesses, but a shortage of businesses ready to receive funding. And that's the funding readiness element. So what do I mean by that? We see businesses with strong market traction, genuine growth potential, but very weak financial reporting, gaps in governance. So quite often there's no operational succession plan, there's key man dependencies, or they don't have the investor-ready documents that funders really look for. And that's really what funding readiness is about, right? Are you ready to receive funding? Quite often, most businesses are not. And these are some of the issues that renders not fundable. And that's the gap our investment readiness program aims to close.
Thabang, let's take a look at that readiness program in a bit more detail. From a program perspective, how does that program then fit into the skills and the knowledge you look to impart on those small businesses in an effort to prepare them for those readiness opportunities? What makes this program that much more important towards small businesses?
So maybe just again, so the program is a 12-month pilot initiative for us, which is really designed to help high potential majority Black-owned businesses operating for at least 3 years, generating annual revenues between $1 million to $50 million, really aims to close that investment readiness gaps and ultimately prepare them to raise funding with Masisi Zane, which is between $1 million to $20 million, or any of the funding partners in the ecosystem. It focuses on four key sectors: agribusiness, manufacturing, logistics, and services. And of course, the goal ultimately, Jim, is to help businesses become fundable, not just apply for funding. So maybe just to dig deeper on what does the program look like. So over the 12-month period, the diagnostic-led program, and I want to double-click on the diagnostic-led part, right, will work with SMEs on the fundamentals that really render them not fundable. What is important is, although the program is for a 12-month period, so not all businesses will be in the program for 12 months, but rather it will be dependent on the gaps identified in the initial gap assessment. So So one of the issues that the program will focus on is some of the financial gaps, ensuring that your accounts, for example, are accurate and up to date, but more importantly, that you are able to speak to them in a language that you understand and in a language that funders understand. Work with the business owners to build budget financial models with realistic assumptions to support the funding request. Right? Number two, how do we then assist business to strengthen operations? So zoom in to understand what are some of the operational gaps in the businesses and how do we improve operational efficiencies. So we look at understanding your sourcing strategy, your pricing strategy, your marketing. Where are the leakages in this business? So that if we close this, we know we're able to improve margins. The other part is focusing on governance. I think as indicated, many of the businesses do not have a clear operational succession plan or have key man dependency. So the mentors then will work with the business owners to understand the bench strength or the lack thereof. And as part of that growth plan, then clearly indicate what resources and skill set is required for what stage to close what gaps. And finally, how do we make sure that we build a market readiness plan to address some of the customer concentration risk that is associated with early stage businesses? Because quite often businesses are dependent on one or two contracts, which constitute at least 70% of the revenues. And if that contract then fall flat, then business then starts begins to struggle.
Thabang, before I let you go, most importantly, how can small businesses get involved in this program? Small businesses are a huge part of our show. They often listen to these sorts of conversations. If a small business is out there wanting to be part of this readiness program and wanting to benefit from this program, how do businesses get involved here and which sorts of businesses should be applying at this stage?
Yeah, so what we look for is businesses that are majority black owned, businesses that have been operating at least for a period of 3 years, generating annual revenues between $1 million to $50 million, businesses that are operating in the agri space, manufacturing, logistics and services. So the program is implemented through two strategic partners, Fetula, which is focusing on agribusiness and manufacturing. So businesses that falls within the sector that are interested to apply can go to fetula.co.za. And then we've got 22 on Sloan, which focuses on logistics and services. Again, businesses that are interested, and I'll urge them to go to 22onsloan.co.za. Or to look at the Masisizane page, which will redirect them accordingly.
Making sure that small businesses are investment ready when it is that they do seek out that investment from the market and other financial institutions. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Head of investments at the Masisizane Fund at Old Mutual, Thabang Hleza, joining us to take a look at their investment readiness pilot initiative and how it is that they aim to roll that out. This interview was brought to you by Old Mutual.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
The segment is brought to you by Omnia, your agriculture partner for more than 70 years. It is Agri Tuesday, and we're going to be taking a look at some interesting regulatory adjustments that have taken place in the Indian markets and how they're benefiting our local agri exporters. I'm joined on the line by senior economist at the National Agricultural Marketing Council, Thabile Nkunjana, to take a look at this and see what to make of it. Thabile, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. In accessing new markets, this is a conversation we've had for the longest time around the agricultural landscape, given the global developments. Sometimes it's not about just signing a new contract. Sometimes a simple relaxation of regulation can be a huge benefit for our agricultural producers and our exporters. What's been happening here with our relationship with the Indian markets?
Good evening to you, Jimmy, and SAEF listeners. Thanks for having me. So the main drive, you know, behind South Africa, especially moving towards the Asia Middle East market, it has been the fact that we have been trying to cushion the impact that has been, you know, that has been observed over the years, given the recent shocks that we have had from the, you know, the drought that we had had sometime earlier before the war in the Black Sea, Russia, Ukraine, and then after that there was a lot of cyclones, climate related issues, and then we move on to currently the Middle East situation. So there has been a lot of drive to say, look, we have commodities that you know there that's so big. And once such a situation happens in terms of the shocks, the impact gets to be so severe such that a lot of households, you know, their livelihoods tend to be at risk. So for the past 10 years or so, then the government has been pushing on this. And part of those, it has been the markets that are within the BRICS. You know, there has been so much talks in terms of how do we push the BRICS, you know, alliance in terms of not necessarily being only politically, but also benefit these countries economically. And with South Africa being the smallest, you know, from the founding or the original, you know, partners of BRICS. So now those kind of, you know, movements towards economic, you know, beneficiary are coming into light. And the recent one you just mentioned is the fact that now, after 10 years since 2017, when we began these negotiations, eventually India is relaxing its you know, requirements for our citrus to get into a big market like India. So we are delighted as an industry to that.
Tabile, let's take a look at those new markets. I mean, from an agricultural export point of view, those are very welcomed. And if we are looking specifically at the Indian market, it is not exactly a small market. We certainly know we're capable of servicing world-class markets because we've got world-class agricultural producers. If we are to look at markets like that as potentially new markets, how does that then set us up to start engagements with other markets beyond India? We almost can use some of these new opportunities as a blueprint to say, how do we fundamentally change our agricultural landscape for the better?
So that's an important point, Jimmy, because I mean, if you are to look into South Africa, specifically certain commodities, we are really doing very well, you know, in terms of our products getting to access certain markets. But these markets, they tend to be concentrated. For instance, you will look in terms of the fruits that a heavy majority of it goes to the European Union. And so now the reality has been that we've seen that it is important that we are really pushed towards that. And with part of the, you know, the state, of course, working with the industry, has been that we are seeing a little bit of decrease not necessarily our concentration within our traditional market. So therefore, how do we look about, you know, other markets, the Americas, North America, South America, in the Asia, Middle East, you know, you mentioned it. So this is part of those drives that, you know, the reality is that we need to really move away from the traditional markets. But now this is not to say the markets that you've already been trading with, like including Africa, which is our currently biggest market, we are not overlooking it or it is less important, but it's important to look at specific commodities. For instance, Africa doesn't buy as much citrus as Europe does, or maybe as Middle East do. So it's important that we will look at those, you know, dynamics of the markets. Also, therefore, the state will work towards pushing to those markets, be it Japan, be it Thailand, be it South Korea, as we are currently doing, you know, for certain foods at the moment. So this is actually the drive behind in terms of let's look elsewhere, not necessarily to overlook what we are currently having, but to just stabilize, to make sure that we are cushioning our entire sector should any shocks come to, you know, to our shores.
Tabile, before I let you go, can we take a look at some of those shocks as they play out in the market? I mean, from our perspective, it would be ideal in all circumstances to be able to weather all of the shocks, but we obviously know it is not possible, and we know that agricultural produce has some very unique challenges that plague the agricultural sector more so than other spaces. Tariffs might be just one conversation, but given the perishable nature of some of our agricultural produce, we have some other challenges that might confront that space. The Indian market looking very attractive, looking very open at the moment, especially with this coal treatment adjustment. From a South African perspective, how do we then bolster our own efforts so that some of these challenges have a less or a limited impact when we go into the global market?
So, I mean, as much as we've been preaching about opening up markets and everything else, we also need to look at ourselves domestically in terms of South Africa, the readiness of it. Yes, we've been trading to the world for the past 34 years since, you know, the democracy and all that. But the reality is we have increased so much production in our commodities. This is in agriculture, in mining and everything else. So with that now, what we have picked is that, you know, our infrastructure to support us to make sure that the commodities that we get to produce really get to be competitive in terms of the, you know, the logistics that are there, the infrastructure that needs to support, you know, all these industries to be able to make sure that all our commodities get to these markets at the time. Because remember, with agriculture, the timing is very important.
Timing is absolutely critical, and that is why our agricultural landscape continues to be resilient and build its level of resilience. We're going to have to leave the conversation on that note. Senior economist at the National Agricultural Marketing Council, Thabile Nkunjana, joining us to take a look at how Indian regulation has adjusted to accommodate for South African exporters. The segment was brought to you by Omnia. Your harvest, our greatest achievement.
Did you know? Recent rain does not always mean your soil is at field water capacity. Omnia can help determine plant available water, giving producers a view of their planting risk profile. It's one more way Soil Insight helps reduce production risk. Omnia Nutriology. Better farming starts with understanding your soil.
It has just gone 7 o'clock. Greg Hosa and the SFM News team are standing by with the latest round of evening news, followed by the top sport team. From my side, good night.